Episode 45, James Sprague.
Welcome to the Oxidative Potential Podcast, where we discuss all things sports science and performance. I'm your host, Matthew DeRoche, and with me is my fellow co-host, Phil Batterson. Enjoy. Good day, folks. On today's episode, I have with me high-performance coach James Sprague. James is currently finishing up his PhD in Cape Town right now in exercise physiology, and he's also had the experience of spending 10 years as a professional cyclist. So this is not too often that you get to see someone on several sides of the coin in coaching as a professional athlete and also in the exercise physiology world. So, James is a very bright guy. You can tell just the second you hear him talk. And it was great to have him on today and discuss all things durability, fatigue, resistance. We dug into his seminal paper that was just released surrounding all the physiological characteristics that are attached to durability and which ones play a role in demarcating that ability. Yeah, so I had a really good time getting to throw out my questions directly to James on some of these things surrounding durability and hearing his answers and what he had to say and his thoughts surrounding it. And so I hope you guys really enjoy this paper. It was a very clear, concise, and effective form of communication that sometimes it can be lost in the research, but I thought this was a great paper in the way that it was written. Super applicable for coaches, athletes, exercise physiologists, obviously. So that will be linked in the show notes. Also, I'll link all of James's social media and where you can find his website for consultation inquiries, all that different stuff. So yeah, hope you guys enjoy this episode and we'll catch you later. Okay, so James, very nice to have you on. I reached out to you just a short while back and you'd come out with a recent paper, so it's really good timing. But for folks that may not be familiar with cycling or your background, your experiences in the field, do you want to just kind of walk people through how you got to the point you're at today and why you're here?
Yeah, sure. No, thanks for having me on. Thanks for the invite. So a little bit of background about myself. So I came up through the British Cycling Talent Development sort of squad as a young athlete, and then didn't make the cut at the age of 18, basically. I'm the same generation as your Geraint Thomases and your Mark Cavendishes. And they were always that little bit better than us. So went off and did my own thing. So I went off to France, lived in France for 3 years, rode full-time there, then went and got contracts in Belgium. So I ended up being an okay professional cyclist, nothing to write home about, but an okay professional cyclist for 10 years. Finished my career and then went back to university, went and did a master's at Worcester University in applied sports sciences with a focus on kind of the application of physiological models to improve endurance performance. And then from there, went on to do, I'm actually just coming to the end of my PhD at the University of Cape Town with Johan Swart as my supervisor. He was working with UAE at the moment. So my PhD is looking at durability or fatigue resistance or whatever we want to call it today in professional cyclists, how we can measure that, how we can train it or improve it, and what determines it. So that's quite my academic side of things that I'm up to. I also work as a coach and an applied sports scientist. So as a coach, I've been working as a coach now for probably over 10 years, coached athletes to probably more than 20, 25 national championships titles, coached athletes to European and world championship medals, work across quite a few different sports, a few different disciplines, all endurance-based. And then also work as an applied sports scientist, so offering kind of consultancy services, your traditional kind of physiological testing, all that sort of stuff to a number of organizations, federations, etc. So kind of fingers in a bit of all worlds, if that makes sense, from the coaching perspective, the academic perspective, and also like the applied sports science side of things.
Very unique path, because I think most people come to exercise science and being applied in the field generally because they're rather poor at athletics, or they've banged their head against the wall for several years, not getting anywhere. So rarely do you see someone that's competed at a very high level and then has turned the coin and provided either coaching or the sports science. So it's very interesting. Now, do you think it was always destined to be that way? Do you think when you spent time as a rider, do you feel like you were the person that was always trying to deconstruct the training process, the metrics, everything that was involved in the process? Or do you think it just naturally pushed that way because you'd spent time in the field and you knew you wanted to be connected to it in some way? Why was it that you made the choice that you did?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in sports science. And actually, my bachelor degree is not in sports science at all, because I wanted to do a sports science degree. But because I was riding at the time, I did an external degree. So I ended up doing a sociology and French degree, which is completely sort of off the track for what I've ended up doing. But yeah, I've always been interested in sports science. I was always partially self-coached as an athlete. So I looked after my day-to-day training, and then I had a few people around me that I bounced ideas off that helped set kind of the overall pattern of the training, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've always just been interested in it, really. I'm quite sciencey from kind of school through. I've always been interested in the sciences. And then I guess when I moved into more of a coaching realm after my career, it was a case of, okay, how can I best help these athletes? Like, I have the sport-specific knowledge, if you like. Mm-hmm. But I think there's areas where I don't want to just be stuck with the understanding that I currently have of the physiology, for example, that you pick up along the way. Like, I wanted to delve into that area and get a bit of a better understanding of it. Mm-hmm. And so that was my motivation to go back to university and do the master's, really, to make myself a bit more of an all-round coach, if that makes sense. Yeah. And just because it's a general interest of mine.
Yeah, it is interesting because it's funny, I was listening to a Val Nasedkin. He works with Omega Wave, but his kind of thoughts around coaching in general should be similar to medicine or some of these other degrees. I mean, obviously it's never going to work that way, but it's always interested me in why more coaches don't have an interest in physiology. I understand the tactical and strategical aspects of sport are very important, and they take many years to build up efficiency and being able to dictate some of the things surrounding those. But why do you think that is? Why do you think that coaches don't have a larger interest in physiology? Because I'm sure you've probably even seen this on the other side in cycling, where there's not always a meshing between what the sports scientist thinks and what the coach is thinking. Why do you think there's such a difference there?
I think people naturally get pushed into coaching roles when they've been in the sport for a long time. And so potentially this isn't that time and space to go away and develop those skills, knowledge base, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think it also depends a little bit on what level you're coaching at. So for example, I'm now working with a really talented ski mountaineer. And obviously nice. that's become an Olympic discipline. So there's quite a bit more investment going into that sport. And I'm coaching him as a physiologist, but there's no way I could coach him to ski. Like his ski level is way, way above my ski level. Like, I can't teach him how to. I'd be there doing kind of snowplow turns with him, and it's just not going to work. Yeah. So I think that when you're working with higher level athletes, it becomes more about kind of training the physiology, if you like, because probably they've had really good coaches in the past that have done all that ground foundation skill based stuff with them, and so you can just come in and work on the physiology with them. But yeah, I think it's a little bit cultural, maybe. Like, we see in cycling, you know, like I said, people end up in coaching roles because they've come through the whole system, and teams are looking for a coach, or national federations looking for a coach. I think generally, I find it difficult to understand why there isn't much more coach development, if that makes sense. Like, people come into these roles or coaching roles with really high levels of sport-specific knowledge, which is incredibly valuable. But there's other things that make a coach, and especially at like a national federation level, like even things like budgeting, things like managing other people, things like arranging travel, logistics, all that sort of stuff. And I think overall, we maybe do a little bit of a disservice to some coaches coming into those jobs by not supporting them to develop those other skills that will allow them to get the most out of their kind of sport-specific knowledge.
Yeah, that's a good perspective there. So one thing I'm interested in is, how has your interest in investigating various things in sports science changed since you got in the field? Because now you're in a very, you know, specific portion of the field where, you know, power duration modeling and seeing the effects of different stimuli and how it affects those numbers. But when you first got into the field, what were some of your big things that you were really trying to wrap your head around? Because was it always surrounding power duration modeling, or is it just, what were the things that you were really trying to talk about? Because you talked about the endurance, like the model, coil and joiner, right? Like, it start there? Was that the kind of thing like, I want to figure out how can we connect the dots here with athletes and performance? But
I think when you first come into sports science, it's a bit overwhelming. Do you know what I mean? There's so many perspectives on everything. There's so many approaches to everything. Yeah. We even have 10 names for the same thing. Do you know what I mean? It's pretty confusing.
Yeah.
I think what I always wanted to do is understand it at its most basic level. So understand what's going on in terms of the physiology at the most basic level that's going to help me understand performance or improve performance for other athletes. And the way I always try and get to a point, and I always think of it like this, is I should be able to explain it to an athlete that's got no background in sports science in 5 minutes in basic language. Yeah. And I should also be able to take that concept and write a scientific paper about that concept. And if I can do both ends of that spectrum, then I understand it to a sufficient level to be able to apply it at an athlete level to improve performance. Because I understand the big picture, those broad strokes about what's actually important in that concept. And I understand the nuances about where it maybe breaks down, where you can't apply it, all those types of things. I think if you get to that point with the structures, the concepts, whatever it is that you use to help inform the training process, then that's always been my goal, to get to that point, basically. I fell into the power duration relationship just because it's so prominent in cycling, I guess, because we've all got power meters. All the software that we use gives you a power duration relationship back. So I think I sort of naturally was sort of interested in that and how we can improve it and what determines it and all that sort of stuff. So that's probably why I ended up going down that track.
Very Feynman-esque. Like, I think who was I speaking with the other day? Oh, I can't remember. Sorry, but essentially, yeah, okay, Sebastian Zeller, he was talking about this Houston, we have a problem, their paper, and trying to basically dissect where is the disconnect happening from sports science and coaches, right? Is it a language thing? Is it an application thing? There's so many different portions of why there's such a disconnect. So it's interesting to hear you honing in on that thing specifically and saying, hey, I want to make this digestible for the people that it's meant for. Because I think, like, going through some of these papers over the years and every time I'm pulling out research for an episode or something like that, and like the amount of dissolving that has to be done to make this presentable. And that's one thing that I really did notice about your paper. I'm like, not only is this effective communication, but this is so applicable for anybody, whether it's an athlete or a coach reading this. They might just have to look up a few terms surrounding, like, okay, W prime critical power. Okay, yeah, power duration modeling, gross economy, these things, gross efficiency. Like, there's not really that much to really whittle down there, because you've whittled it down so well, and you're not doing anyone a disservice, I don't think, by doing that. Because as a scientist, the information's there, and for the athlete and the coach, it's fairly easy to digest. So I just want to say good job on that part, because that's just something I've noticed over the years is, it'd be nice to just be able to send off a paper to an athlete or a coach and just be like, hey, have a read through this. But many times it's not something that's easy to do. So let's actually get into your paper here, the relationship between physiological characteristics and durability in male professional cyclists. So this was just published just recently. So do you want to give us, because we chatted a little bit before the podcast and like why you wanted to put this out, but how did you get to this point where you're just like, this is the next thing here?
Yeah, so there's a lot of work coming out in cycling at the moment under what we'd probably call the umbrella term of power profiling. So that's looking at power outputs, essentially looking at how they change over time, looking at the power duration relationship, and drawing inferences from that about the underlying physiology, about strengths and weaknesses, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the vast majority of that work, or recent work is probably more accurate, has been done from power data recorded in races and in training in athletes. And I've done a lot of that work myself with a colleague, Peter Leo. I co-authored on all his papers during his PhD, and he's now doing the opposite in mine. And we did a lot of that. We looked at, okay, what's happening in races? What sort of power outputs are athletes doing? Is this declining over time? Are there different kind of types of athlete, how they produce power, et cetera? I think that's really good, and it's a really nice first step to say, okay, what's going on in the field? But there's a lot of caveats to that sort of work. So how we record power output in the field, what we call MMP values, so mean maximal power output values, so the maximum amount of power that an athlete's done over a 2 minute continuous period, for example, or a 5 minute continuous period. That struggles to capture some of the efforts. So we don't know if those efforts were actually maximal in nature or were they submaximal or how stochastic, how on and off was the power during that effort. So there's a lot of caveats that come with basically doing that sort of research. Doesn't mean it's not valuable, but it means there are limitations to it. And so we felt it was time for the field of kind of durability, if you like, fatigue resistant, which is what my PhD in, and that kind of comes under that umbrella of power profiling, to say, okay, well, let's get athletes back in the lab. Let's get back to the basics of being a physiologist. Let's get them in the lab. Let's do some pretty standardized testing with them. Mm-hmm. Let's develop some tests that replicate what's going on in the field, and let's see what's happening with the physiology. Let's not just infer what's going on with it. Let's actually measure what's going on with it. And so it's a pretty basic paper we put out. Basically, we got some athletes into the lab and we did a whole kind of host of physiological profiling with them. And then we developed a test that replicates the same sort of demands that they're placed under in a race. And we looked at, okay, how does their critical power, so the power that they can sustain aerobically, change? And how does their W prime, that the power, the amount of kind of work capacity above that critical power, how does that change over time during a race, or in our case, before and after this fatiguing protocol? And what are their measures in the lab? And are there any correlates between those two? So is one thing more important than another thing in terms of durability? Let's start with that as a nice starting point. And then we get an idea of, okay, what's important in terms of more durable athletes have this, or less durable athletes miss this kind of capacity. So that's basically what we did in the paper.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the nice things that, you know, right off the hop in the paper were the kind of characteristics that you summon under durability, like the metabolic changes, neuromuscular, muscular trauma, these things. Do you, like, if you had to summarize that, how important do you think some of these are in the relevance for professional cyclists? Like, do you think some would be a little bit more influential to try and tweak than others? Because obviously, I checked out the reference on that. It was actually a really good paper. It was like 2003. I can't remember the author's name, but yeah, because when we're trying to approach this whole durability concept, we might work on one thing, but that one thing is going to attack several different approaches and characteristics. So what are some of those specific ones do you think that are going to play the biggest role? Like, we're not going to, like, just before we get into the paper, because I'm sure people are interested in, like, yeah, what are the ones that are?
Yeah, so fatigue is a really complex area to study, as I found out while writing my literature review. So there's so many things that influence our ability to perform. And one of the challenges, if you like, is we've always looked at fatigue in terms of task failure. So we've said to athletes, ride at 300 watts, and let's see how long you can sustain that for, and let's look at what happens when you can't sustain the 300 watts anymore, which is a really nice way to do it, but it's not really reflective of the real world, because athletes can still carry on cycling at the end of a bike race. Yeah. What we're interested in is what the change in those maximal efforts look like. So let's take a sprinter. That's the easiest example. If you get them to do a sprint at the start of a race and you get them to do a sprint at the end of the race, how much power do they lose over that duration? And that's basically the important thing, because bike races are won at the finish line, not at the start line. So, but they can still carry on riding. So it's not like they've reached task failure per se, but just their maximal performance capacity has declined. So that was the first kind of challenge. And so there are lots of things that influence that, from metabolic changes within the working muscle, cardiovascular fatigue potentially, so loss of economy of the respiratory muscles, motivational factors, so how motivated was that athlete at the end. There'll be some central nervous system fatigue and some peripheral fatigue in terms of how the muscle is activated, potentially some biomechanical changes, like are they sitting on the bike in the same way at the end of a race as they were at the start of the race. There could be some muscle trauma issues. I think that's a pretty small one in cycling, because we don't really have any damage. Yeah, exactly that. So if you're looking at trail running, for example, that would be a huge factor, maybe less so in cycling. And it's not like there's just one of these taking effect. Every one of them is taking effect to a greater or lesser extent. Mm-hmm. And because cycling isn't run off at a constant power output, so it's not like we all do 300 watts and then we sprint at the end. There's efforts within that. And the efforts are different relative intensities for different individuals. it's really complex to see what's going on to ultimately cause this decline in performance. So therefore, we started with what we could measure is the simplest way to answer this. So the easiest thing to measure from as a physiologist is the underlying physiology. Relatively standardized lab tests that we know are sensitive to change. So we know we can pick up relatively small changes in these factors. We know that they're important for performance because there's umpteen papers that have come beforehand that says this measure is important for endurance cycling performance. Mm-hmm. And so let's measure those things and then let's compare them to change over time. So that's basically what we did. We started with the stuff that we could measure nice and easily. And being a physiologist, I obviously started with the physiology. I'm sure a psychologist would have started with the psychological factors potentially. So that's how we got to where we were with the paper. And I think personally, and I say this because I'm a physiologist, I'm sure, we can explain a lot of the variance in performance with physiological measures only. It doesn't mean that all those other factors, psychological factors, for example, aren't important in terms of elite performance. Of course they are. No one's saying they aren't. But probably if we had to pick a discipline, if you like, a scientific discipline that explained the biggest variance mm-hmm. of performance, we'd probably come down in terms of physiology. So that's one of the other reasons why we started there.
So I'd like to take a quick moment here to introduce you to a new sponsor of the show, which is Moxie Monitor. Now, I'm sure you've heard Phil and I discuss Moxie Monitor or Nearest Devices on the podcast before, or perhaps maybe a guest that I've had on the show speak on Moxie or Nearest Devices. Now, what Moxie is, it's essentially detecting oxygen saturation at the level of the tissue that it's placed over, which can be extremely useful for sports performance, training intervention, understanding different profiles in athletes, desaturation slopes, resaturation kinetics, also, you know, connections to ventilatory thresholds or lactate thresholds, day-to-day readiness. There is no shortage of use for near infrared spectroscopy like Moxie. So if you guys want to get a 5% discount on a device, I'll leave a link to that in the show notes. It's OXPO in the promo code box, and you'll get a 5% discount. So just want to say thanks to Moxie, and this has been one of the most reliable devices I've used in my practice with myself and athletes. So shout out to Moxie.
No, that was a perfect. I realized when I put that question out there, I'm like, that wasn't as clean as I would I would have liked it to be. But you did a great job in answering that, because for most athletes, there's very few things like within this model where we're talking about fatigue that you can actually measure quite well. And even that, measuring the metabolic capacities of an individual, there's still a step removed from being on the field generally most times. Yeah. So so when you were putting this forth initially to kind of test durability, were you seeing, like, because the performance VO2, fractional utilization, all that stuff, the model that Coyle and Joyner put together, were you looking to enhance that and say, hey, is this going to be the next kind of metric that we can really hone in on and have some type of protocol to measure? Or were you just saying, hey, we just want to see first. We just want to see what's happening first. Or did you really think at the start of the paper that I think we might have something here that's very important for understanding this model? It's probably going to be the next piece.
Yeah, so I mean, the work had come before my work suggesting that let's call it fatigue resistance durability is the fourth parameter of endurance performance. So Ed, who you spoke to recently, actually had a really nice paper in SportsMed about that. If we look at Andy Jones, did a paper with the Breaking 2 guys, that all the athletes in Breaking 2, and I think from memory, a few of them, from their fresh values, were capable of breaking the 2-hour marathon, but obviously only Kipchoge went on to do that. Mm-hmm. So there was this kind of fourth component of, okay, how much does your performance capacity decline over time? There was some nice work within cycling. So there's probably two papers, one by Peter Leo and myself as part of his PhD, where we looked at differences between groups racing in the same race. So we basically saw that the guys that were getting top 10s were seeing no decline in their power outputs over time. The guys that were really struggling in the race were seeing a much bigger decline over time. Mm-hmm. And then there was another paper by Turn Van Erp, Deo Sanders and Rob Lamberts that showed the difference between, let's say, successful and less successful sprinters was not the power output that they could do in a fresh state, it was the power output they could do in a fatigue state. So we had some good idea, okay, actually it's performance at the end of a race or the end of an event that is a big determinant of performance in terms of results, if that makes sense. Let's look into that and let's see, okay, what are the physiological characteristics that determine that? Because it wasn't like nothing's a settled issue, but there was a lot of evidence already accumulating that this is an important component of endurance performance. So we were like, okay, well, let's take the next step, get back in the labs and see what we can investigate the underlying physiology of that.
Yeah, it's when you say that, coming from a sports scientist, exercise physiology, fatigue has been around, like this complex problem of fatigue has been around for a while. People have understood, like, yeah, this is an important fact, but with coaches, it's quite the contrary. Like a lot of the times, even when there's very few coaches that I can hear like saying out loud or putting on paper or presenting, putting forth, whether it's in books or whatever they're doing, is how important fatigue resistance is for performance. Like I've heard Moore speak on this several times. It's like, you know, who cares about your max watts, really? It's all about what is your max watts after 3 hours of work. And I've always seen a disconnect there, because as much as we lump everything into one thing, like talking about like aerobic performance, it's all just kind of one thing, and maximal power output, it's all just this one category. But yeah, so getting into the paper now, critical power testing initially fresh, right? Then yeah. you essentially did all the other tests along with it, like the gross efficiency at 200 watts, 300 watts. And essentially you place another test upon them after different workloads, right? So that was the framework that you started with.
Yeah. So through a lot of pilot testing, we developed a test or a fatiguing protocol, is a better way to put it, that seems to replicate the amount of fatigue that athletes are experiencing in races. So I actually presented the data that we used to validate internally that test at a conference recently. So we basically got athletes to do our fatiguing protocol, and then we measured their critical power and their W prime after it. And from that, we could model their power duration relationship, let's say, in a fatigue state. We then compared the power outputs that we were expecting against the power outputs that they were doing in races at the end of the races. So we had a few athletes that, luckily, in professional races, were in contention for the win on an uphill finish. And so we looked and said, okay, the finish climb was, I don't know, 8:34. Our model says that they can do 412 watts, and they did 411 watts. I think the most we were ever out was about 4 watts. So we were pretty confident that this kind of fatiguing protocol was at least replicating to a close degree the same amount of fatigue that athletes were presenting with at the end of bike races. And we tried to make that as simple as possible. Firstly, so athletes would do it more than once, and so it was controllable. So the simplest we got it down to was essentially repeated bouts of 8 minutes above critical power. So 8 minutes on, 8 minutes off, five of those between 105 and 110% of critical power. So actually a pretty typical sort of training session that athletes might do. And then, yeah, we did on day one, if you like, we did a critical power test fresh state.
Yeah.
Day two, we did this fatiguing protocol and then the critical power test in a fatigue state. And day three, we did a lab test, and athletes were fresh for all those. There was a bit of time between all those tests, so they were nice and fresh, and they were actually in a randomized order, but that's how we did it.
And looking at the individual data and the charts that are below, it's interesting to see some of those individuals lost very little. Well, the delta in critical powers was very small, if anything. And then looking at the W prime, there's three individuals here that had an increase in W prime. So were those connected to the individuals that had little changes in critical power?
The increase in W prime, we saw three athletes with small increases in W prime. Mm-hmm. It's probably an artifact of the modeling. Mm-hmm. So best practice recommendations when you do critical power testing are to do at least three, ideally maybe four or five. Tests in the severe exercise intensity domain, and then use a predictor from all of those measures to give you your critical power and W prime. Mm-hmm. Because of the kind of demands that we were already placing on athletes with the fatiguing protocol, we use the simplest version of the critical power and W prime test that you can, which is a 2-test model. So a 3-minute and 12-minute test. Mm-hmm. And that was validated by some of the guys at the EIS, the English Institute of Sport. Mm-hmm. And really, you can only use it in athletes that are habituated or very used to doing efforts of that duration, because you basically need perfect pacing.
Yeah.
So I would say those small increases in W prime were probably an artifact of a little bit of mispacing in one of those two efforts. We did have a few checks and balances on if those efforts were maximal in terms of like hitting maximal heart rate, never dropping below their critical power, et cetera. But it may be just that there was a little bit of an issue there. And it may also be we don't have a handle on what the daily variability in critical power is. Mm-hmm. So we don't. If I'd get you to do a test today and you got 15.5 kilojoules, for example, we don't know what the day-to-day variation in that number is. So it may be that the differences that we saw were actually just within daily variation in terms of the W prime estimates.
Yeah, well, once you said that, I forgot that it was a two-test model. I'm like, yeah, the W prime is definitely going to be less accurate than that. But I mean, the critical power is really what you're trying to hone in on for the most part, I'm guessing. Yeah, so, and especially because you have the fatiguing protocol, trying to organize that in a way where it would make sense for every athlete. Yeah, it would be very difficult. So what were the correlations that you've seen between some of these physiological tests, gross efficiency, VO2 max, relative power max? What were the big ones that stuck out, and how did that work into your equation of saying, hey, we're actually, this is a fairly reasonable equation to predict?
I think so the first thing to say is that critical power values didn't correlate with fatigue resistance or durability. So it's not that athletes with a higher critical power were more durable. We just didn't see that at all. And that's when we normalize things as a percentage as well. So the first thing to say is that you can't use a higher critical power value as a proxy for increased fatigue resistance or increased durability. Mm-hmm. We'll start with W prime because that's a little bit simpler. Almost nothing correlated between the changes that we saw from a fresh to a fatigue state in W prime, what we call delta W prime, and the lab characteristics, apart from a carbohydrate oxidization at 300 watts. So 300 watts was in the heavy exercise intensity domain for all our participants. And we got, I think, 0.6465, something like that, a negative correlation in this case. Yeah. So it explains maybe 40-odd% of the variance, something like that, in the differences. And that kind of is in line with what other studies have found. So there was a study coming out of Japan that showed that athletes in a glycogen depleted state do have a smaller W prime. So it makes sense that if you're using less carbohydrates in those sort of tempo efforts, you're sparing glycogen stores, and therefore you might be maintaining your W prime a little bit better. The delta CP, so the change in critical power from a fresh to a fatigue state, essentially correlated with all measures of good aerobic fitness. So what we call PMAX, so the power that athletes got to at the end of a ramp test, correlated nicely. VO2 max itself correlated nicely when normalized to body mass. RCP or VT2, respiratory compensation point, correlated nicely. VT1, so the first threshold, also correlated nicely, both normalized to body mass and unnormalized. Gross efficiency not correlated, at both at 200 and at 300 watts, and carbohydrate oxidation at 200 watts also correlated nicely with that change. So basically all those, any way that we try and measure basic aerobic fitness seem to correlate with increased durability. Those athletes that were more aerobically fit maintain their power output better, to put it simply.
Funny, this is just on the top of my head, but there was a couple papers that had came out recently, I think 2016, maybe 2018, on critical power and type 1 fiber correlations. Do you think something like this could improve that kind of modeling for trying to understand, hey, we're looking at maybe a larger ratio of type 1 fibers? Because to me, trying to understand the oxidative potential, kind of what's driving all this kind of ability to resist fatigue in a lot of ways metabolically, is Yeah, it must be related to fiber type, because when we're trying to hone down to it on a small physiological level, what do you think that is? Do you think that's more so fiber type or?
Yeah, that would make perfect sense, because increased sort of muscle, sort of type one slow twitch fibers, whatever you want to call them, is related to increased oxidative capacity. Mm-hmm. And that would show up in all these measures that we have. Until you measure it, you can't confirm it. But I think that's a pretty fair hypothesis. The paper that you're talking about came out of Loughborough. Richard Ferguson was the senior author on it.
Mitchell and
And that basically showed that the more oxygen you can get into your type 1 fibers, the higher your critical power will be, which kind of also makes sense from a hypothetical standpoint. So, yeah, I mean, muscle fiber type, if there's one thing extra we could have measured in this paper, unfortunately, it wasn't possible. But yeah, muscle fiber type would have been a really nice kind of addition. And I'm sure someone will go on and do that. It's just a little bit tricky to do we only had professional athletes in this study, so it's a little bit trickier to do in those sort of populations. So
no one's wanting to get muscle plucked exactly. out.
No one loves a muscle biopsy. So yeah.
Yeah. So obviously seeing the changes in critical power, how do you think these things correlate well? I mean, because when we're measuring endurance performance in the lab, that's one thing. Do you think these things are going to correlate fairly well in the field? Like, I'm just asking in your own personal perspective, like, is this how, because I know obviously we're not watching these guys, like we have no idea who these riders were. Do you see the same order happening in the field as well?
Yes. So with the riders that we have in this study, obviously we know who they are.
Yeah.
The riders that we see performing better in the field also perform better in these tests. Their drop off in critical power was much smaller. And actually, when we first started playing around with protocols to be able to measure durability, mm-hmm. we got some really quite funky results, and we're like, hang on a minute, this doesn't make sense based on what we're seeing in the field, what we're seeing in training, what we're seeing with these athletes and race results.
Yeah.
And we actually had to tweak our protocol. Basically, it seemed that we weren't inducing enough fatigue to separate out and pull out the athletes, so we had to make the testing a little bit harder to be able to do that. And then as soon as we did that, we got this ranking of athletes that if we'd written down beforehand, we would have ranked the athletes in a similar sort of order. And then we obviously double checked that against the power outputs that they were doing in races. And it seemed that, okay, our estimates from this protocol are really close to what we're seeing when they're producing maximal efforts in races. So then we were pretty sure that we had a nice protocol that was reflective of at least induced a similar fatigue to what athletes are experiencing in races.
Mm-hmm. So your practical applications of this, do you think this is, obviously, when we're talking about power duration modeling, this is a first step for a coach, right? Because obviously most coaches don't have access to metabolic cart. They might have lactate, some of these different things that can aid in trying to get a picture. But do you think this is going to be seen widely throughout sport more often now, is testing the change in critical power? Do you think this is going to make a shift? Do you think people are going to catch on to this and say, hey, this is what we should be looking at in terms of metrics?
Yeah, I think so. I think actually coaches have been doing it for a while. Like I know even when I was a professional cyclist, people were doing a 20-minute effort at the start of a ride and a 20-minute effort at the end of the ride to see where they were at. So this has been going on for a while. Mm-hmm. I think what we're trying to do is formalize that a little bit, provide a protocol for coaches that they can use, that they can have some confidence in, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I know most, just speaking with kind of colleagues and friends working in professional cycling teams, mm-hmm. this sort of fatigue testing is now what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But I think we wanted to move it past just pulling that data out from sort of raw power files that are a bit influenced by so many other things, and just give people a tool like a standardized testing protocol. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing I will say is that the test that we have in this paper seems to work well for continental under 23 riders, maybe ready to step up to the world tour.
Yeah.
If you were to use this at this particular test or exactly as it is in, for example, world tour GC guys, it wouldn't be sufficient to induce enough fatigue. You wouldn't see any difference between riders. Mm-hmm. So it will need to be tweaked, if you like, or made more intense or have them accumulate more work if you want to apply that to the best in the world, basically. But for the population we had, it worked quite nicely.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is, like even for the people listening, I think this will be a useful model for them to understand, especially because in recreational cyclists, people are still very adamant on testing, right? They're looking at all these testing measures. And I think critical power, for some reason, it's not as popular in the recreational field. FTP is kind of the number, but hopefully people are starting to see this. And even with FTP, it's the model still works. I think obviously it's just tailoring it to understand, okay, what is a good state here that's going to be repeatable for me over the next 5 years, maybe, or next 3 years. But yeah. So moving off of this, what are the next investigations that this has sparked for your work? What are the things that you really want to hone in on at this point now?
Yeah. So I think we have, it's part of my PhD thesis, and hopefully we'll get it published at some point. So the composition of that prior work, we think will also have an influence on durability, or that the magnitude of that downward shift in the power duration relationship. Mm-hmm. So if you've got repeated sprints, for example, against something like that we did here, so 5x8 against something like a continuous endurance exercise, exactly the same amount of workload, so let's say 2000 kilojoules, the hypothesis is that we will see different responses in the power duration relationship based on that prior work, even though it has the same kilojoule amount. And most of the research, or in fact, all the research up to this point, has only looked at work done and quantified it either with kilojoules or kilojoules normalized to body mass. It hasn't taken into account the intensity of that work. Now, that's important because if we look at like a mountain stage and we look at a classic, like something like a Tour of Flanders or Paris-Roubaix, the amount of total kilojoules might look quite similar, but the kind of the distribution of intensity looks very different in those two efforts. And we hypothesize, and we've got some data on the way, that suggests that some riders respond better to one type of work and are more durable to one type of work than they are the other type of work, or vice versa. So that's where we need to take it from here, I think. And then we can look at, let's take in a professional cycling team context, you have your classics group, you have your sprint group, you have your GC group, for example. It may be that we need slightly different fatiguing protocols to test durability in those three groups that are more reflective of kind of the efforts that they will have to do within the races that they're targeting. So that's the next research that should hopefully be coming out from our group.
That is interesting, because I think most coaches, you're around long enough, you realize the response to, we're doing, whether it's running 6x800 or whatever it is, the drop-offs on those, or the same thing with sprinting, like the drop-off on sprints for individuals is very indicative of their ability to tolerate certain amounts of work or certain intensities of work. And training individuals, you realize that approaching those two kind of separate sides of the coin the same way doesn't tend to work out the best. I'm really interested to see more work from Phil Bellinger and some of the investigations that they've done on response to overreaching, overtraining kind of thing with fiber type. But yeah, that's interesting. I think that's a really clever direction to go. I think that's smart, and it makes a lot of sense. What is some other things in the field outside of power duration modeling that you have interest in at the moment? Or are you just full board down this? Or is there some other things out there that you're interested to see, whether it's heat adaptations or different things and signaling there? Or what are some other things that you're interested in?
Yeah, so my focus has been pretty durability led, basically because that's my topic of my PhD thesis. So getting that, it's now fully written. So it's with my supervisor for checks. So that's been the focus of most of my energies, I guess. I think there's some really interesting work in, which is related fields of force velocity profiling in cycling. That's something we haven't traditionally used enough, I don't think, to maximize, especially sprint performance. Altitude's a really interesting one for me. I mentioned earlier, I work with a Eskimo athlete. Obviously, they only compete at altitude. So that's really interesting, but they're coming away from altitude when traveling and stuff in between races. So maintaining that adaptive state, if you like, so that they can turn up perform at altitude and then travel to the next event and then perform again. That's quite an interest. Heat, my focus was on heat a little bit earlier because I did some work with some athletes running into Tokyo on heat and they were really successful. They won medals there. So yeah, I guess my interest in the heat stuff has died off a little bit probably not as, I mean, I have no athletes working towards a competition where heat is going to be one of the big problems that we have to solve, if that makes sense. But obviously running into the Tokyo Games, it really was. So yeah, I mean, anything that I'm interested in, anything that my athletes are dealing with at the time. I've never liked doing research for research sake. It always has to be solving a problem that one of my athletes has or I have as a coach or something if I knew a bit more about this, that would really help my, help how well I could help other athletes. So that's always been how I'm led, I guess, with the questions I try and answer.
Yeah, altitude is such a complex problem, just understanding the internal physiology of an individual and how that responds differently. Such a complex problem. It's been around for a long time. It's funny because it's been around for so long, but the headway that's been made in altitude is, well, now we have a much better grasp, but it's still like it's been just step by step by step, very slow. But have you come across JB Marin's work with force velocity profiling? Have you heard of him?
Yeah.
And something that I've been quite interested in over the years too is also transferring that in the weight room and seeing the force velocity profiles from the weight room to the track. And it seems to be fairly correlative, which is interesting. And it makes a lot of sense, obviously, but also for the direction that individuals are being trained in the weight room, because that's one thing I've always noticed. I don't know if you've noticed this, is like when we talk about endurance sports, just like, all right, absolute strength. That's just the end of the discussion. Absolute strength and hypertrophy. We'll do some assistance work. But, you know, looking at some of this research on VBT over the last decade, I don't understand. Like, I think the gains that people are making in the weight room and why people really don't see much value in it. A lot of people don't see a ton of value in it is literally because they're looking at, let's do 30 minutes of aerobic exercise 4 times a week. Yeah. You're going to make some gains here in the first couple of years, but the scrape that's still left there for most people, I think there's so much there. And I'm glad VBT is starting to get more popular, but not just even VBT. There's a lot of new methods out there. Not new, they've been around for a long time, but that I just don't see being taken advantage of, especially when we're trying to manipulate the force velocity profile. So what about with your athletes now? Is because obviously, like you talked about, this has been something that's been used for a long time, power duration modeling, right? And changes in power duration modeling over fresh and fatigue state. How has this changed your practice? And is there things that you're experimenting with in your practice now that you think might have some?
So I guess all my athletes now, my road endurance athletes, let's say, test them in a fatigue state. We maybe do one fresh state test at the start of the year, and then most of the testing throughout the season will be in a fatigue state. One of the other papers that I put out as part of my PhD, we managed to show that there's actually more fluctuation or more variability in the fatigue power profile than the fresh power profile across the season. So if you're not testing in a fatigue state, you might not be picking up the changes that are important. So you can have an athlete pretty consistent CPW prime across an entire season. However, they're going to see more fluctuation after 2,000 kilojoules or 2,500 or 3,000 kilojoules. So actually it's those changes that we want, because that's where races are won or lost. So pretty much all my endurance athletes are testing in a fatigue state. Not so much for track, because it's not so important, but you might just come on the track and have a 40-minute event, for example. So Madison, so it's not so important in those disciplines, but certainly road endurance, most of the testing now done in a fatigue state. And then just doing everything you do normally, but for that. So you're like, okay, let's test it. Let's see what your kind of power duration relationship looks like in a fatigue state. Let's go away and do a block of training, and then let's test again and see if we've moved the needle, how far we've moved the needle, et cetera. All those things you used to do to a fresh CP test or a fresh FDP test or a fresh lab test, whatever you're using. And then going back, retesting and seeing how far you've moved the needle, going, okay, but we'll just do that to performance in a fatigue state, because we think that's probably a more important metric than fresh state for certain sports and disciplines. So yeah, a lot more of that. I think there'll be some interesting stuff coming up around fueling, I think, around how we can improve durability through fueling. A colleague of mine recently did a paper looking at 90 grams versus 120 grams and saw some differences there in endogenous and exogenous carbohydrate utilization. Mm-hmm. So that would be, that potentially has its implications for durability. I think prior to this point, we hadn't really, I think a lot of people understood fatigue was important in endurance sport. That goes without saying. But I think that this idea that you measure the delta change and classifying that as durability has opened a few doors and a few ways of thinking about ways to investigate how we can make athletes a bit faster. So I think there's a lot of interesting work coming up.
Yeah, it's genius. It's funny, I came across a paper years ago now. It's double polling cross-country skiing, similar to that. Should we be testing athletes in a fatigued state? I can't remember the authors of the paper, but when I first came across it, I was like, I think this guy's onto something, especially another way that, I mean, I see a lot of people prescribing the training zones off of fresh tests is another thing too. And the changes in VT1 for sure are there. And that's always something that I've scraped my head against and never really found too much use in is if you're going to dictate training zones off of a lab test, it would behoove you to have the lab tests replicate their normal training week, especially when you're on the sharper end, because there can be some big differences there. But yeah, no, this has been great, James. If people, I'm good to link the paper in the show notes, right?
Yeah, sure.
I'll link the paper in the show notes for folks, and I'll link all your social media and whatnot in there as well, and where people can find you and your website. Yeah, so really, really appreciate you coming on today, and great work on the paper. Just such a solid paper. Like I there's just a lot of work sometimes that I think is, it's overcomplicated for what we currently actually know. And this was just a really good presentation on, hey, this is what it is. So yeah, thanks a lot for coming on.
No, thank you for having me. And it's nice to get that feedback. You never quite know how work's going to be received, obviously, when you put it out there. Obviously, you've got to get it past the reviewers and get it into a good journal to start with. But it's nice to know that it's approachable and accessible and useful and stuff for coaches as well. That's always the goal. So it's nice to hear it's maybe hit that mark.
Yeah. All right, folks. We'll catch you later.